Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Following yesterday's meeting in the Oval Office, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that he intends to take concrete steps on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And some say tensions between the U.S. and Israel seem to have been eased. Joining me to talk about the U.S.-Israeli relationship and implications for regional security, Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, which is a relatively new pro-peace, as it's described, pro-Israel advocacy group. Robert Satloff of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and from a studio at the Maine Public Broadcasting Network in Portland, Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Welcome to you all. Nice to have you with us this morning.
Good morning.
You can join our conversation. You are wonderful listeners at 1-800-433-8850, as always. Or you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Jeremy, as I mentioned, there has been... there was a lot made of the theatrics yesterday. The last time Netanyahu was here, very frosty, no photos, no meal, no flags flying over Blair House. Yesterday, an enormous effort to try to change the atmospherics. But what did it mean?
Well, the question is whether there was any substance discussed behind closed doors. The public signals that came out were clearly that the relationship is strong, that the U.S. stands with Israel's security, and both men were playing to domestic political audiences. But the deeper meaning, I think, will be played out in the weeks to come. Will there, in fact, be follow-through on the prime minister's promise to take concrete steps towards actually resolving the conflict, or is this all for show?
Rob Satloff, you were quoted before the meeting as saying this was doomed to success. What did you mean by that, and in fact, did that happen?
Well, it is always good to have a prediction come true. It was doomed to success in the sense that both the president and the prime minister had a very strong interest in changing the public perception of their relationship, strong in strategic sense and strong in the political sense. It is never good for an Israeli prime minister to govern at a time of U.S.-Israel tension. And it is never good for an American president to be seen as the instigator of that tension. And both needed to repair this a bit. Now, there was some news that came out of yesterday, which was very important, where the president said he expects direct talks between Israelis and Palestinians to start in just a few weeks, well before the end of the Israeli commitment to a moratorium on settlement construction in the West Bank. And that's an important development because that will help ensure, if it does happen, that there is unlikely to be a repetition of this collision between U.S. and Israel in the next few weeks.
Now, Aaron Miller, you were quoted in the New York Times as saying that this tableau yesterday reflected a false calm and that there were likely to be fissures under the surface that would come to the fore because there was an expectation gap. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think there is a significant expectations gap. You've got a potentially transformative president who came out louder, harder, and faster on the Israeli-Palestinian issue than any of his predecessors. In fact, he got way out ahead of himself, certainly on the issue of settlement activity, without a strategy to actually succeed. So you've got a guy who believes that in 48 years, the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will either materialize or join the dustbin of history. He's serious about this. He wants to do big things. On the other hand, you've got a prime minister pulled by his own ideology, his coalition constraints, and his fundamental suspicions about all of his Arab partners, who has a low delivery capacity. And the reality is we are just at the beginning of what is going to be, I suspect, within 4 to 6 months, another roller coaster ride in the U.S.-Israeli relationship and in the Israeli-Palestinian relationship as the moments of truth, the first that the prime minister has to face internally, the second in the U.S.-Israeli relationship on what constitutes the endgame, and the third between Abbas, a determined, well-intentioned but weak Palestinian president, and an Israeli prime minister who is sleeping with one eye open.
What about this point that Rob Satloff just made, Aaron, that this promise? How significant, in your view, was this promise to take concrete steps? And what do we know about what they might be, concrete steps toward direct talks?
Well, you got two issues in the concrete steps category. One is stuff on the ground, easing additional economic restrictions, removing checkpoints. A second is expanding the Palestinian security presence in mm-hmm. areas of the West mm-hmm. Bank where they're not, where they are now not currently in control. CBMs, comfortably measures, though, are one thing. Moves in the negotiations on the four core issues, territory, security, borders, and refugees, that's quite another. Now, whether the prime minister gave the president, and this guy, Obama, is not a sentimental guy when it comes to these matters. He was looking for something substantive. Did the prime minister deliver some assurances on two of the least contentious issues, borders and security, which may have buoyed Obama's hopes and justified what is clearly a dramatic improvement in the U.S.-Israeli relationship? We don't know.
What do we know, Jeremy? Do you, David Makovsky, a well-known expert on this subject and a frequent guest on this program, said that there perhaps were signs that there was, in fact, a private set of assurances exchanged yesterday, including perhaps a willingness on the part of the Israeli government to extend the freeze on settlements, which, as you gentlemen pointed out, due to run out at the end of September, which Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, has said that's a basic precondition for them entering direct talks. What do we know about what might have been said privately? You got any sense from your sources?
Well, I also think that Aaron hit the right point, which is it isn't just the settlement freeze. It is this question of whether or not the Israelis have begun to respond on the substantive questions on the final status issues, particularly borders and security. The Palestinians are saying that they've put forward ideas, that they have outstanding proposals on the table, questions to be answered. Up till now, the Israelis have said they won't engage in that conversation until there are direct talks. So that's really, I think, the nub right now of the stalemate. And if the Israelis are willing to show their cards a little bit, we may be able to get to direct talks without the settlement freeze issue being the stumbling block. That could happen before the deadline for the settlement freeze.
What's your feeling on this, Rob? Is there a possibility of some private assurances having been exchanged yesterday that would move this process forward?
Well, I thought that it was very important that Barack Obama, the president, reaffirmed publicly and in categorical terms his trust of Benjamin Netanyahu. He took on that question directly. And that question
And that's
goes,
been a very real question.
That's a very real question. And I think, in my view, the only way he took it on so directly is because he received something from Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. Not specifics, but some measure of commitment that gave him the ability to say this. I do think we are overlooking one huge contextual point, which was the other big issue in these discussions yesterday, which is the Iran issue.
Sure.
There really can be no doubt that the American commitment to prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb is the litmus test for Israelis and Arabs in this region of the strength of character of this president and his willingness to go and protect his assets, protect his commitments. And it's only in that context will Israelis and, I think, Arabs take real risks for peace. And Netanyahu seemed to be convinced that the president was on the right path. But the real test here will come a couple of months from now, a few months from now, when we judge whether sanctions have made progress or not.
But it is true that the United States has pushed for ever tougher sanctions on Iran. And that, as you say, that did seem to be received well by Netanyahu on that one then issue.
Yeah, what we've seen is, I mean, this month has been, as Bob Kagan said, the trifecta of sanctions, you know, the UN sanctions, Euro sanctions, U.S. sanctions. But sanctions are effort. Results are actually the change in Iranian behavior on the nuclear program. And that will be the test.
Aaron David Miller, another gesture. We talked a lot about confidence-building measures, two actually, that Israel took leading up to this meeting. One is that after that the deadly attack on the flotilla trying to resupply Gaza, there was a lifting or at least an easing of some of the restrictions on goods allowed into Gaza. And then yesterday news that an Israeli prosecutor had indicted an Israeli soldier for manslaughter for a death that had been in Gaza. Talk about the importance of those measures. And are they, you see any significance in them?
I mean, I don't see the Israeli overall strategy changing on Gaza. I think in response to their own botched commando raid, international pressure, and paradoxically, Barack Obama's determination to use the Gaza crisis, while the rest of the world went mad on the issue of Gaza, only the United States kept its cool in an effort to work with the Israelis in order to deliver what it is they got. But the broad strategy on Gaza, it seems to me, is not going to change. The government of Israel is not going to change its political, economic, or security policies in the main with respect to Hamas. As long as Gilad Shalit remains a prisoner of Hamas, no Israeli
this
prime minister—
This is an Israeli soldier who was captured by Hamas.
Four years ago. No, yeah. Israeli prime minister will be able or will be willing to make life in Gaza attractive to Palestinians. Now, the middle class is disappearing. Hamas is emboldened, even though I'm not sure its gains were as dramatic as some of its defenders would like to allow. And it continues to import, not through overland passages or by sea, but through tunnels, all the components necessary to assemble high-trajectory weapons. I don't believe, and this gets to the whole question of the Palestinian Humpty Dumpty, which relates back to the issue of how are you going to create an Israeli-Palestinian agreement when you've got two divided Palestinian leaders controlling two separate constituencies.
We'll get back to that and your comments, your questions, your emails from my experts on our Palestinian situation in the meeting at the White House yesterday. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane. You stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the meeting yesterday at the White House between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Barack Obama, and the future of Israeli and Arab and U.S. relationships. It's really a three-cornered relationship. With me today, Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, an advocacy group here in Washington, Robert Satloff of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and by phone, Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org. Jeremy, one of the dimensions here, look, nations always operate on self-interest, but the mood, the personality, the relationships between leaders matters. We saw this in the Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev relationship. We've seen it many times as being an important factor. What do we now know? The Obama-Netanyahu relationship clearly got off to a lousy start. Do you see a change here? Do you see a significance in the new mood, there is, in fact, a new mood?
Well, you know, I think that this is something that has characterized the presidency on a variety of issues, that the level of presidential warmth and personal engagement, whether it's on Capitol Hill or with world leaders, hasn't been what, for instance, a Bill Clinton or a George Bush could bring to it. And I think that's been a dimension of this that is missing. I think the connection of the American president to the Israeli people, the level of trust that this president really understands Israel's security needs is somewhat missing, and I think that he does need
to go. Why is that? Why is that missing?
Well, I think there is a built-in defensiveness in Israel to the notion that the international community may pressure it to do something that is a further sacrifice in order to try again to make peace. And I think that the Israeli public is only willing to make those sacrifices if they feel that it is in the context of a leader or a country or a world that understands the obstacles and the challenges it's up against. And I don't think that the president has been able to convey that yet directly. And I think the indication that he's looking at a visit to Israel is important. I think if he's going to press harder on this post-November, post-September, I think it is extremely important that he visit Israel and that he make that case directly to the Israeli people and explain the personal connection that he has and the understanding that he has.
And Rob Satloff, part of the context here, of course, President Obama, from the day he took office, was besieged by economic domestic problems. He's also fighting two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One has a sense that this issue, this perennial issue of, how many dozens and dozens and dozens of times have Israeli leaders come to the White House and talked about the peace process, that this is not a particularly high priority for this president. Is that a fair impression, or is it simply a question of the circumstances where other issues have just demanded his attention?
Well, you have to separate out which issue you're referring to.
Okay.
If you're referring to the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that's one point. If you're referring to the strength of the U.S.-Israeli relationship and Israel's security situation more broadly, that's a second point. The president did come in and on his second day of office appoint the highest level peace envoy for this issue, Senator George Mitchell. And he committed himself from that statement to pursuing Israeli-Palestinian peace. What he didn't do from that first day of office at the same time was give that same level of personal commitment to Israelis about their own unique security situation. And we've had several instances over the past 18 months where America's what I would call global interests seems to have trumped its special interest in this relationship mm-hmm. with Israel. We saw it. We would have heard a lot more about it if the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the final document, if the Gaza flotilla crisis hadn't pushed it off the headlines. But here's an example where the Bush administration, and even before it, was willing to say, no, we're not going to accept a final document that singles out Israel, and was willing to bear the brunt of that, you know, standalone situation. Whereas the Obama administration said, well, our global interests in non-proliferation trump this local interest. We're going to condemn the final document, but we're still going to go along with it. That sent a shiver in the minds of Israeli security leaders about when these two interests collide, the global mm-hmm. and the local, which one is going to win out? Now, the president did make a big effort yesterday to compensate in his public statements.
He did say that there was a unique situation
exactly.
that Israel had.
And that's really to try to compensate for that larger statement that was made at the NPT conference.
Aaron David Miller, I want you to talk a little bit about, in addition to Obama, as I said, there are really three players here. Netanyahu heads a center-right government, or maybe a conservative government, depending how you want to describe it, which is, and Israelis voted for a government that was more resistant to the peace process, more hostile. Netanyahu campaigned on that. Give us your sense of where he is now. One of the comments, New York Times editorial this morning took note of the fact that Netanyahu never mentioned a, quote, two-state solution, the formula that has been repeated many times by Obama and his predecessors like George Bush. Where is Netanyahu today? What do you think his instincts are? What are his political possibilities?
My conceit on this is that Bibi, to use his patronymic, is at war with Netanyahu. That is to say, you have a tough-talking Likud Pal whose very instincts, essence, his need to maintain his connection to the tribe, his party base, his father, his revisionist history, his martyred brother, all of this tends to make him suspicious, withholding, and quite narrow on the issue of being magnanimous or statesmanlike when it comes to dealing particularly with the Palestinians because they're so, quote-unquote, close to home. That image, I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not trying to do psychobabble here, but that image is in direct conflict with Netanyahu, a man who, the fifth Israeli prime minister to serve twice in non-consecutive terms, a man who fashions himself quite the strategist, a man who wants to lead the state of Israel out of the shadow of the Iranian bomb and to make peace, some sort of peace, with Israel's neighbors. That conflict is very much in evidence in Netanyahu's style, his one step forward. And we saw this the first time around in 96 to 99 when he was prime minister. Then one step backward or maybe two and then two or three steps forward and then two or three steps backward. He doesn't know, I would bet a lot right now, where he is on the issues that will be required if he's going to move forward and maintain the trust and the confidence that Rob Satloff referred to that he may now hold partially with an American president. And that tension is going to be exacerbated by a president, a yes-we-can president, who is confronting perhaps a no-you-won't Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Therein lies the tension. I don't agree, even though I believe the prospects for an Israeli-Palestinian conflict and an agreement are slim to none. I think you have a president, a wartime president with a Nobel. We haven't had one of those since Woodrow Wilson. And the fact is, if you look around the world, all the other issues he's involved in, Afghanistan, Iraq is even questionable over time, Iran, they're all much more hopeless than this one. I think he believes and is prepared to take a run at this one. Therefore, I think you're gonna see more tensions, inevitably, in this relationship.
Let me ask you, Jeremy, this inner conflict that Aaron describes in Netanyahu as a political figure, that conflict runs right down the middle of Israeli society, does it not? I mean, this ambivalence, this great yearning for peace, and yet this great suspiciousness of are the Palestinians really capable of being effective partners in a negotiation? I mean,
absolutely.
Is this a larger reflection?
And as we've also, I think, focused in this conversation so far on the U.S. interest and on the short-term interest in the Israeli-U.S. relationship, but there's a long-term, even medium-term, Israeli interest in resolving this conflict. This conflict has to end because there is no future for the state of Israel as a Jewish and a democratic nation if you don't have a two-state solution. If the occupation continues, Israel will become further and further isolated. It will become the subject of international campaigns for one person, one vote, and the entire nature of the Israeli nation will be at risk. And so this isn't simply a political conflict of one man. It also is, as you say, a fundamental debate within Israeli society where the majority of Israelis do understand this is the resolution of the conflict. There must be a two-state solution. There must be sacrifices. On the other hand, they don't know that they have a partner. They don't know if they have the confidence to take the steps necessary. The U.S. must weigh in, not only for its own interest, but really to save the state of Israel for the long run.
And that's one of the reasons why they voted for a Netanyahu, a conservative government. There was an increasing disillusion with the peace process in some ways.
Right, and a sense of insecurity and a sense of uncertainty about the future, and people turn rightward in a moment like that. They need the assurance. The reason, in the view of a group like J Street, a pro-Israel, pro-peace group, that a meeting like yesterday is important is because the confidence in the U.S.-Israel relationship is an absolute precondition to making any progress at all. So the president must embrace the prime minister and the state, but at the same time as he's hugging, be pushing relentlessly for the compromises and the sacrifices that are needed.
Now, Rob, talk about the third party here, the Palestinian leadership, Mahmoud Abbas. Been described as well-meaning but weak, lost control of Gaza entirely to Hamas, now really just controls the West Bank. One of the key questions over many, many years has been the willingness and the ability of a Palestinian leader to negotiate seriously. What's your reading now about where Abbas is and what his possibilities are?
Yes, we're in a situation which is almost the exact opposite of where we were, say, 10 years ago when we had a strong Palestinian leader, but one unwilling to make the real concessions and unwilling to commit himself to peace. That's Yasser Arafat. Now we have a situation where we have the Palestinian Authority which was created by the Oslo Accords. Mahmoud Abbas is the president. His term of office expired about a year ago, and they can't have another election to affirm him again. We have a prime minister who is named Salam Fayyad, who is building up a very effective bottom-up economic and security infrastructure in the West Bank, which is an important precondition for really having the infrastructure of statehood. And then we have in Gaza a totally opposed leadership, the Hamas, Islamic Resistance Movement. We shouldn't forget what the acronym stands for, which is a radical terrorist group, as seen by the United States, which opposes all of this, opposes peace, opposes Israel, opposes Abbas, etc. Abbas clearly as opposed to terrorism and war. We don't know yet whether that negative is enough and if he is supportive enough of the compromises that Palestinians need to make in order to reach this, cross the divide between Israelis and Palestinians. Is he strong? Does he control Fatah? We hope that he will show himself in the negotiations that we hope will begin directly very shortly.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to some of our callers, many of whom want to join this conversation. Let's start with Joyce in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Welcome, Joyce. You're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been very interested in this discussion. It really approaches the Israeli-Palestinian problem from a more global viewpoint, but I am involved with an organization that is, as I see it, chipping away at the bottom of the problem. We have just started a group, a nonprofit, for Israeli and Palestinian university students to come to D.C. in the summer. We have our first group of 10. They have non-paying internships. They stay with host families who are all Americans. And they are working at places like ALMEP, the Alliance for Middle East Peace, one Israeli, one Palestinian, and an Israeli at the American Task Force on Palestine, and a Palestinian at the Americans for Peace Now group. And I see them as the next generation, the people for whom this conflict will be real in their lives and who should have a say in what goes on. And I think we're trying to give them that.
Thanks for your call, Joyce. Jeremy, talk about, this is one of many efforts that have been made on a personal level to have conversations between Palestinians and Israelis, bringing students to this country, creating dialogues in the Middle East. What's your reaction to Joyce's comments?
Well, you know, of course, I'm deeply personally supportive, and J Street's very supportive of all of these kinds of efforts, but the decisions that need to be made in the coming months, and I'm saying months, not even years or a decade, are political decisions. The leadership of the United States, of Israel, and the Palestinian people will have to decide in a matter of the next 12 to 18 months if they are very serious about a two-state solution or not. And that's where the conflict will be resolved or it won't. There will be a two-state solution or there won't based on those political decisions. So I think it's extremely important for the long-term health of the region and of the peoples for there to be dialogue and exchange and the people to get to know each other. But I don't think it can have the immediate short-term impact. The urgency on the ground is extreme. If you speak to King Abdullah, for instance, from Jordan, his prediction is that if we do not have some movement on the diplomatic front in the next 12 months, there will be another war of one kind or another. And that's, I think, where our focus needs to be, is how do we give the political space to political leaders to resolve this conflict now?
Let's turn to Andrew in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Andrew, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for taking my call, Steve. I appreciate it.
Happy to have you. What's on your mind?
I got a chance to speak with Mr. Miller a couple of years ago at the University of Michigan. I'm not sure if he remembers our conversation, but it was a pleasure meeting him then, and I'm happy to be on the call now. I guess my comment is that as an Arab American, and I guess I'm relaying the sentiments of other Arab Americans, although I can't speak on behalf of the entire Arab American community, that President Obama is destined to continue to fail in his attempts to bring Israel and Palestine closer together for a just peace. If he does not legitimately hold Israel accountable for decisions that Israel makes that really undermine the potential for peace. For example, there has not been a real moratorium on settlements. Israel has released a number of different plans to, you know, expand existing settlements and also create new ones in occupied East Jerusalem. Additionally, Palestinian homes are being demolished on a regular basis, and this directly undermines the faith that Palestinians have in a legitimate peace process. The other thing that I guess many of us are frustrated about is the entire conversation about nuclear armament in the Middle East, and the fact that President Obama made the comment that he would, you know, sort of push forward with having Israel sign the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, but at the same time, he still feels the need to make these statements about his commitment to upholding Israeli security. As far as I'm concerned, asking Israel to sign the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and recognize that it has a nuclear arsenal is not controversial. And the fact that we treat it as such continues to paint Israel as this victim, and that victimhood allows Israel to continue to, you know, act aggressively towards the Palestinians.
Andrew, thank you very much for your call. Quickly, Aaron, response on the settlement question.
Now, there's no question there's an asymmetry in the relationship between the United States, the way it treats the Israelis, and the way it treats the Arabs and the Palestinians.
You'll have to hold that thought. I'm afraid we're going to have to take a break, but I'll get right back to you as soon as we come back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We're going to have more of your comments and your questions, so stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Parking garages have been part of the urban landscape for more than a century. The past and future are these utilitarian structures, and how good design can contribute to civic life. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, our subject this hour, the meeting yesterday between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama, and the future of Middle East peace talks and the promise, as it was voiced yesterday, of concrete steps toward direct talks in the near future by Prime Minister Netanyahu. Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, a pro-Israel advocacy group, is with me. Robert Satloff of the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. And Aaron David Miller, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Aaron Miller, I cut you off. I apologize. But answer more fully the comment of our caller who said, well, the settlement freeze is not really serious, as well as the larger question of Israel's nuclear capacity.
I'm not even going to try to reconcile the issues of morality and fairness with history and politics. I mean, Andrew raises some very good points, and there's an asymmetry in the way we treat Israel and the way we treat the Palestinians and the Arabs. There has never been what I would call strict accountability, and there never will be. I worked for six secretaries of state. One of them, Jim Baker, basically came closest to imposing a measure of accountability. He had to. He was on the verge of putting together a Madrid peace conference, so he denied $10 billion in housing loan guarantees to the Israelis. But the reality is that the U.S.-Israeli relationship, its foundation, the value affinity, its security, domestic politics, our regard for Israel's security, all of these things prevent us, compel us, essentially, to look at Israel in a different way. My only hope is that we do not allow the special relationship, which does serve our interests, to become exclusive. And therein gets to the real problem. Barack Obama is going to have to be tough, and he's going to have to be reassuring. He's going to have to use honey, and he's going to have to use vinegar, not just with the Israelis, with the Palestinians as well. But he's going to have to find a way to calibrate this relationship, because if he's looking for somebody to plant a tree in his honor for delivering an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, it's never going to happen. He's going to really have to be tough and reassuring. And that's my hope, even though it's not my expectation.
We have a number of emails that pick up on this very question, Rob Satloff, and this one comes from Eric in Cleveland. Are there any benefits, he writes, are there any benefits to our relationship with Israel? I understand the political realities of why we support Israel, but putting that aside, do we get anything out of our relationship with them economically or strategically?
The answer is a definitive yes. Israel is an enormous strategic asset to the United States in many different ways. I'll just give you the simplest equation. Over the last 25 years, the United States has spent enormous sums for the defense of the broader Middle East. In the Persian Gulf, we've spent about $1 trillion, and we've sacrificed about 4,000 American lives. And we still have no security in the Persian Gulf. In the Eastern Mediterranean, we've spent about $100 billion and no American lives, and it's a secure part of the world. Why is that? That's because Israel projects power, and there's been no regional war around Israel and its neighbors since 1973. It has been a region of regional stability. Now, everyone says the Middle East stability. Well, you have to look at it more specifically. The area around Israel has been an area of regional state-to-state stability. The area elsewhere in the Middle
East, although there have been cross-border battles with Lebanon and in Gaza, and
all very restricted. Even the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has been horrible for Israelis and Palestinians, in which thousands have died on both sides, has had almost no impact on the area's regional states. In fact, Egypt and Jordan, despite all the shrying, have maintained their peace treaties with Israel now far longer than anybody predicted would be the case when they were signed.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I just think it's really important, though, to recognize that the dynamic is shifting and that the festering of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is beginning to erode fundamental American interests around the world. And American military sources, leading diplomats, the Secretary of State said this in her address to AIPAC, the world is changing. And when she was First Lady 10 years ago and she would travel around the world, no one mentioned this conflict. Today, she travels anywhere in the world. This conflict is the first thing she hears from foreign leaders.
And is that part of the incentive that Barack Obama is thinking about? I mean, he has made an enormous effort in his Cairo speech and others to reach out to the Muslim world and on a personal basis, using his own story as a link to connecting to Muslim communities. And what always gets thrown back at him is this question. It's one of the issues that it gets thrown back at him.
Right. The focus of July of 2010 can be on the quality of the hug given by President Obama to Prime Minister Netanyahu. But the focus over the coming years has to be on what's really in American and Israeli long-term interests. And the status quo today is unsustainable. It runs against American interests. It runs against Israel's long-term interests. It is immoral, and it requires a resolution, and it will require the kind of American engagement that is more perhaps pushing in the future than hugging, even if the dynamics today are around the hug.
Let me turn to Kathy in Toledo, Ohio. You've been patient to wait, and we are happy to have you on the Diane Rehm Show. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to know, how does the IDF know that if they bomb Gaza or shell or fire missiles into Gaza, that those munitions haven't landed on Gilad Shalit, maybe hurt him or killed him.
Aaron, do you have an answer for Kathy?
No, I mean that's an intelligence question, and I have no way to answer that. The Israelis operated in December of 08 and January of 09 for 3 weeks in very close quarters, with an enormous amount of munitions being dropped on Gaza in an effort to stop Hamas's high trajectory fire. It's who knows exactly, because it's clear they don't know where Gilad Shalit is. If they did, by this time, they might have actually tried to get him back.
Here's another question from a listener, Bob Wittenbarger in Charleston, Illinois, Rob Satloff, related to the previous one. It is truly depressing, he writes, and puzzling to listen to so much talk about Netanyahu and Obama, Israel-U.S. relationships, and so incredibly little about the conditions of life and the prospects for and obstacles to their improvement among not only the Gaza Strip but the West Bank. Who does care about the Palestinians, Bob writes?
Well, clearly the people who care about Palestinians are Americans. We give an enormous amount of aid, far, far exceeding most of the aid recipients around the world. And just the last year, we've seen an enormous improvement. The West Bank had an 8% increase in gross domestic product, while the United States, I think, would be envious of this sort of increase in the time of global recession. We know who doesn't care. We've seen pledges go unfulfilled from Arab states to the Palestinian Authority now year on, year on, year on. We know that most members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference have pledges that are unfulfilled to the Palestinian Authority. We do know that Gaza is not starving. We do know that there are thousands of trucks that cross the border into Gaza. It is not thriving either. And that can change with a change in political leadership and a recognition that their lot lies with a peace process and not a war process.
Let me turn to Dean in Traverse City, Michigan, for a somewhat different perspective. Dean, we're happy to have you. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be on. I'm glad to talk to all you people. I've listened carefully to the conversation, and I hear the word compromise for the Palestinians. Let's see now. There's a 500-mile wall, and it's a wall with a turret every 300 meters apart with armaments in it. Israel controls the food. They control the water. They control the medical. They control the fuel. They can control the monies that come in. They control everything. What's the compromise? They're knocking down people's property. You know, when they talk about this settlement stuff, I want to do. I get sick. I get nauseous. That's absolutely, it's adverse possession. I want to talk about settlers. Now, those squatters, this has been going on. The Palestinians lived there for 2,000 years with the Jews and with all the other people that lived there. And then the Zionist group came in that just does these things. I hate tyranny. I don't hate any peoples. Matter of fact, I had very good and still have very good Jewish friends. But they're not the same as the Zionists. And my passion is we are expending trillions of dollars over there to support something that is not very nice, in my opinion. Okay. So my question to you is, how are you going to justify this when you screamed about the Holocaust?
Okay, Dean, I appreciate your call. Jeremy.
Well, I think there's no question that the occupation and the settlement enterprise itself is an immoral enterprise, and that is one of the aspects of this. The unfortunate thing about these types of conflicts is that morality does end up taking a second seat to national interests. And the good news, I think, in this particular situation is that national interest and morality coincide. It is time for the occupation to end. It is time for a two-state solution. And every party to this conflict has an interest in that happening sooner rather than later. And so while I share the caller's passion, I think that we have to remain rational. We need to build a base of support, which we're trying to do right now through J Street and through our Community of Yes campaign, to say to the president, there is support. all through this country, from Jews, from Christians, from Muslims, from all Americans who want to see a two-state solution. And the president should know that he has the support around this country to end this conflict and to end the occupation.
Rob, you wanted to add something?
Here, I do need to part company with Jeremy. I think it's just not appropriate to refer to what is going on as immoral. The Israeli occupation was occasioned by the 67 war. Since that time, Israeli governments of both left and right have sought efforts to achieve peace with various neighbors. It is not by choice that Israel is occupying the West Bank. One can legitimately criticize the settlement aspect of the occupation, but the occupation is at its core a military occupation in the absence of peace with Israel's neighbors. And that is what needs to be remedied, which is a recognition of Israel's acceptance and legitimacy by Israel's neighbors, which would effectively lead to the end of the occupation.
Let me bring in Barbara from Farmington, Connecticut. Barbara, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thank you. I just feel that if the United States wanted peace, we could have it. But we're using the Israelis and the Palestinians and Muslims in general to manage our ability to control whatever resources we can get our hands on in the Middle East. And I don't think morality should have to take a second seat to national interest. That is horrible. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Barbara. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Aaron David Miller, your response to Barbara.
Oh, look, I'm not a declinist. I'm a firm believer in American power when it's used wisely, and even a firmer believer when there's an opportunity to use American diplomacy. But the notion that the United States somehow, or that Barack Obama somehow has it within his power to end this conflict is the kind of hubris and arrogance, frankly, that has gotten us into trouble in other areas of the world. The trillion-dollar social science project that some people refer to as Iraq, the notion that in a discretionary war we could transform an entire society, this kind of thinking that the United States can basically do what it wants, a great power wandering around in a world of small tribes, is not only wrong, it's dangerous. The reality is this conflict continues because Israelis and Palestinians refuse to consider and pay the price for what it would cost to end it. As desperate as we think they are, the sense of urgency that truly brings national leaders to make the kinds of decisions to create the basis for an end conflict ending agreement isn't there. Barack Obama can do a lot, but unless the straw is there, he's not going to be able to fashion the bricks. And at the moment, the straw isn't there.
This is a fairly gloomy assessment of the outlook. Rob Satloff and Jeremy Ben-Ami, I want to give each of you quickly a chance to sum up here and give us your sense of where this is headed after this meeting yesterday and the concrete steps that have been promised. What can we expect now in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, I think the near term is actually quite rosy. I think we're likely to see a start to direct talks in some fashion. We're likely to see the Israelis satisfy the Americans on some matter of settlement construction moratorium. For me, the big issue is the larger regional context. If the Americans are able to fulfill their commitment on Iran and the nuclear program, then that reduces the risks for everybody so much that I think that there may be the chance for real progress and perhaps even a real peace deal.
And what about Aaron's point that the straw is not there for making the bricks? You seem a little more hopeful. Why do you disagree with his atmospherics here?
Well, because I don't disagree with Aaron on the narrow question. At the moment, between Israelis and Palestinians, it's not there. I think one has to only envision this in the context of an American president fulfilling his single most important foreign policy commitment to date, which is to prevent the Iranians from achieving a nuclear bomb, which changes the regional context completely.
Jeremy.
And Rob and I part company on this as well. I mean, I think that the litmus test, the notion that that is the entry price to fixing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is to prevent an Iranian bomb, I think is setting up for failure. I don't think it is necessarily possible to prevent, and therefore we're setting up a test that can't be met. Sanctions are unlikely to work. The Iranians are likely to continue progressing, and the best way to build greater international consensus around stopping Iran is actually to address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict first, and to reach a resolution there, perhaps a regional resolution that then puts extreme pressure on Iran to back down. So I put the ordering of things in the reverse order from Rob. I think that it is incumbent on the American president to push. I think he will find that there is a receptivity both in the Israeli public and in the Palestinian public, 60 to 70% support for a reasonable two-state solution. And American leadership would be pushing against a door that would open, not against a brick wall.
But what about this focus on that we saw yesterday in the White House, the Israeli-American relationship? Where are we on that right now?
Well, I think it's clear that there is a strong signal from the White House that the relationship is solid. But I think the more important thing is that the president must move beyond narrow domestic political considerations. He has to put the U.S. and American interest first in trying to achieve peace here. And if he does that, he is also putting Israel's long-term interest at the forefront. The interests of the two countries do coincide in resolving this conflict, and we have to get beyond the political perception that he has to pander, in a sense, to Israel.
That's Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, a pro-peace, pro-Israel advocacy group. Rob Satloff of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy has been with me. And from Maine, public broadcasting by phone, Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and very much appreciate your spending an hour of your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.